Recently, the Food and Drug Administration required that food companies change over to a new nutrition facts panel on their packages. And we'll take a look at what changed and how food labels can help you choose a healthier diet. With our guest today, Beth Olson, back in the studio with us. She's an associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we'll take a look with her at labels, talk about what needs to be in your diet to be healthy, and take your questions. Are you confused about nutrition labels? What questions do you have about your diet? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Beth Olson, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there was a time when there was little or no information about nutritional value on the labels of the food that we buy. Let's do a little history here. When and why did that all change?
Well, I think it changed started changing as early as the 40s, 50s, 60s, and before then, people bought food, whole foods, or they grew foods in their garden and they cooked them at home. So there just wasn't as much need to know everything that's in a packaged food. But as packaged food became more widely available, more widely used, the government came to understand they needed to provide some information for people to make healthy choices. And in addition, some big reports came out from the government on the role of nutrition and health. And so there began to be a desire to have people point towards foods that might reduce the risk of, say, cancer or heart disease or diabetes. And in order to do that, they had to have better information on their labels.
What were those first labels? Did you ever see any of the really early labels?
I did. They were scarce, just a tiny bit. Not in person. I don't want to imply that I'm that old. But in history documents. And the other thing, as time went on, even as we made them more standard, they were still voluntary, so not completely standard. So they could be a little confusing. The same kind of food could have, for instance, a different serving size depending on which company put it out. So the early ones also just weren't as standard as what we have today.
Yeah. And now we've got some more change here.
Yes. And I don't know if many people realize, but it's been about 25 years since the Nutrition Facts Panel.
That long?
Yes, that was the beginning of my career. I actually was at a food company when that happened, so I got to live through the entire transition, and I got to know that particular label really well. I don't know the ones today quite as well, because that's not the prime area of my job, but it was a big deal to revise the labels. And so 25 years, as you can imagine, things have changed. The recommended amount of nutrients people need to take in has been revised. The federal government looks to the U.S. dietary guidelines to provide guidance for all their programs, and those have changed. So there was a need to update the Nutrition Facts Panel as well.
All right. So as we look at the new labels, what do they include that wasn't, you know, maybe more specifics about what was included now that wasn't before?
Yeah, so it when people glance at it, it does have a similar look still.
Yeah.
It's not terribly, horribly different, but there were some key changes. A big one that people had been asking for a long time was the addition of the line added sugars. Prior to that, we just looked at total sugars. But given the amount of added sugars that people were consuming, the tendency of those to displace other nutrition, they really felt people needed to be aware of how much of the sugars in each of those foods were added. Also at the top, you'll see there's some, the font is bigger in some areas. They felt like people needed a little more call out in their nutrition facts panel of serving sizes and how many calories are in a serving so that people were really aware of how much they were eating. And then a couple of changes, a little bit smaller perhaps, is they de-emphasized total fat. We now know that it's all the types of fat that we ought to be more concerned about in our diet. And they changed a couple of nutrients at the bottom that are required because the ones that were on previously, people seem to be doing pretty well with, but we're not doing as well with a couple of others like potassium. So they added that on.
Lois in Verona emailed that she's had heard that drinking apple cider vinegar is great for your digestion, as well as generally good for your health. However, after trying it, she found it to be pretty distasteful and hard on the throat. Is there a pill form?
I'm not aware that there's a pill form, but, you know, there's a lot of pills out there, so I can't say that there isn't one. I don't think the evidence is very good that it does anything for you. We have other foods in our diets that are acidic or are not acidic, and our stomachs pretty much handle that before it gets very far into our system. So I'm not sure it's worth it, particularly if, like Lois, you don't enjoy it.
Yeah, and if it might feel burning on your throat.
Exactly. That's, you know, it is acidic, so I think it's probably not good for her, and I don't think it's really worth it in terms of our overall health.
I use it all the time in cooking, and it's fine there, but I don't know that I've ever taken a sip of it, of it directly to know what you're talking about, Lois, but and now I'm not going to either. You can join in, too. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org, or you can call in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or comments about the labels or just nutrition questions like Lois had here. So you think these changes, has the food pyramid changed at all, really?
Well, we no longer have the food pyramid.
Yeah.
Now we call it My Plate.
Yeah.
And it has in that it's put a lot more emphasis on fruits and vegetables and whole grains than our previous dietary guidance has. So I mentioned the dietary guidelines come out. They come out every 5 years, and they underlie all our nutrition programs. And then USDA takes that and puts it into a visual representation. So, you know, for us older folks, there was the four food groups.
Yeah.
Then we had the food guide pyramid. Now we have My Plate. My Plate is very much a visual representation. It alone won't give you all the information you need, but we use it as a teaching tool along with other information. And it really does emphasize fruits, vegetables, whole grains.
Well, let's see. What have I got for lunch today? I've got a little sandwich. I've got an apple and a couple of cuties and a low-sodium V8. Low-sodium V8.
Sounds like you're on your way.
Is that a good?
Yeah, sounds like you're on your way for the day.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, how does the label actually, and we'll get to Ryan here in Madison in just a second, how does the label help you choose an overall diet? Because, you know, you've got all these different labels.
Yes, I think that on the side panel, the nutrition facts panel and the ingredient list that's just immediately underneath are your best ways to choose a healthy food or a food that you're looking for something in it in particular. Maybe you in particular want to restrict your sodium or you in particular want to add more fiber to your diet. You can get it there. I think putting the two together is the most important thing. So look at the nutrition facts panel. And if you aren't quite sure if you're seeing what you need, look down at the ingredient label. So if you're really interested in whole grains and it's got some fiber, but you're not sure, look down at the ingredient label and see, does it have whole wheat or another whole grain listed.
Ryan and Madison, now we'll go to you. Thanks for calling, Ryan.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about, as far as the nutrition label, sugars that they report, are they only report like actual sugar, or do they have to list like artificial sweeteners they put into food and drinks as well? Because a lot of things say they're sugar-free, but there is a lot of sweetener in that for being sugar-free. So I'm wondering how that gets reported on the nutrition label.
So there's two places to look, and I think this is an excellent question. In the nutrition facts panel, they list naturally occurring and added sugars, the way that you and I might often think about sugars, things like white sugar, brown sugar, honey, high fructose corn syrup. So that'll be totaled up in the nutrition facts panel. In the ingredient list is where you'll find if there are any artificial sweeteners. I don't know offhand if they call them out as being an artificial sweetener. You might need to know what the name is, for instance, aspartame, to know if it has an artificial sweetener in. But if it says it has zero sugars and it's pretty sweet, It might have an artificial sweetener in it.
Yeah, I would bet. Ryan, thank you for calling. Keith in Arborvitae, your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hey, Larry. This is
have a comment to help out the lady that was taking the apple cider vinegar?
Yeah.
I take it every day, and it aids in helping digest your food and weight loss. But I read up on it, and if you drink apple cider vinegar straight, it eats away at the walls of your esophagus. So I dilute mine with like 30 milliliters of apple cider vinegar to 20 ounces of water.
Ah.
And it tastes better.
Yeah, I bet it does, Keith. Thanks for calling. Well, that would certainly be a help, wouldn't it, Beth?
Yeah, it would be help with the acid. I'm still not sure that it's an effective digestive aid, although if it works for somebody and they aren't harming themselves, I certainly would mention it to my primary care provider when I went in that I was doing that in case you did have any underlying issue with your esophagus and stomach. And some people do. They do have conditions that where those linings are already vulnerable. So I would mention it. Another way would be to mix it into salad dressing and cook with it, as you were noting.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me. Well, you can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. There always seems to be some sort of fad diet out there. What's the big one now?
I think the big one now is the keto diet. It's a variation on the diets that we've been seeing for really quite a long time, which is lower in fat, higher in protein, or higher in fat, I'm sorry, and in the case of the keto diet. And the idea is to try to get your body to think that it doesn't have carbs coming in by restricting your carbohydrate intake pretty significantly. And then we mobilize fat to make ketone bodies. That's why it's called keto diet. Ketone bodies aren't something that we use all the time for energy, but when we don't have enough carbohydrate, we do use them, particularly for our brain.
Well, I tell you what, we're Betsy and Rippon. I hope you can hang on there. We'll get to you in just a minute. Beth Olson, our guest today, she is an associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the UW-Madison. Great to have her come by and talk with us. We are going to take a look at the news, the weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet. And then we will be back with Beth Olson. She'll be with us right up till 12:30. You stay with us. Taking a look at nutrition labels today and also a healthy diet and what it means with our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. The guest, Beth Olson, associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at the UW-Madison. Great to have Beth back, and we certainly look forward to hearing from you with your questions and comments. Our lines are all filled. I promised Betsy and Rippon we'd get back to her as soon as we could. So let's just get to her right now. Betsy, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I'm calling about aluminum in our diet, and that it's loomed its head again by the fact that in this Princeton Berlin Times, a Green Lake County wellness nurse has said how bad it is for us, that it could be a neurotoxin. It could be leading to dementia and Alzheimer's. I wonder if she had the latest on this.
I don't have the latest on toxic exposure. That would be probably other people here at the university who would have more insight on the amounts that are in, say, water supplies or some kind of groundwater. In terms of food exposure, it's generally very low. People haven't been found to have had problems from a normal healthy diet in terms of the amount of aluminum they're exposed to.
But the water on that side, well, no, we've got a water show coming up, a water quality show coming up, Betsy, so stay listening, and that's a question you could certainly pose to those folks. Appreciate it. Well, Dan in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a concern about the new food label, nutritional label. In the past, it was really easy to see if a food containing fat was probably containing too much fat. Someone had, maybe it was NPR, had something on this, but you know, if you took the calories per serving, they also listed the percentage of fat in that, you know, based on the fat content. And it was real easy to see that if it was higher than 25%, that might be something I would choose not to purchase. So is there a new quick way to look at the label and kind of get that same idea?
Yeah, unfortunately, Dan, you'd have to calculate it, kind of like you were talking about. You have to kind of take the total fat and the calories and then divide by the total calories. You know, personally, actually, I'm with you. I liked the percent calories from fat on the label.
Yeah.
I think what the government looks at and what all of us look at in the nutrition community when we're putting out dietary guidance is, if we put it out and we don't achieve the changes that we had hoped for, then what we put out for the population at large then wasn't that helpful. And I think what they found was we put so much emphasis in past decades on total dietary fat, and people did make some changes to their diet based on that, which were good, but they also made some changes which weren't that good, which is they substituted, you know, so in a very broad way, when we said, you know, we'd like people to eat a little less fat in their diet, we meant, you know, if you were having 6 or 8 cookies after dinner, could you have a apple or a bowl of fruit instead? And instead what happened is people started consuming reduced fat cookies or reduced fat crackers. And so they weren't substituting in some of the foods that we were concerned that they weren't eating enough of because they had these diets that were higher in fat. So I think after these years, finding that there just wasn't the ongoing change in diets that we had hoped for, the decision was made, let's not emphasize total fat as much, because then people weren't paying attention to another big role for fat in our diets, which was having a variety. So having not as much saturated fat and having more poly and monounsaturated fats, because those have been shown when substituted for total fat or for saturated fat to improve our health.
There we go. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Pete in Wales next. Hi, Pete.
Larry, thanks for the show. And Beth, thank you for being there. What is your opinion about artificial sweeteners? And Beth, do you know of major studies that have been sponsored by food companies or sugar companies that were trying to downplay the health of people using artificial sweeteners?
Well, certainly if there's an interest in an ingredient, you tend to get some research funded by those people that make that ingredient, because they're the ones that care the most. But I don't offhand, I can't tell you which studies were funded by various commodity groups or food companies and which weren't. These days, when we I'll check it study by study. These days, we have to disclose in everything we do. When I speak at a meeting and I put up my data, I have to say, where was it funded? All the places, industry, government, everything. When you become a member of scientific panels, you fill out big disclosure statements. We have to put it into our research. So now when we publish the paper, we have to say, where was the funding? And that has helped a lot to understand who is funding what research. But in general, I would say, for instance, the U.S. dietary guidelines indicate that for most people, the amount of artificial sweetener they consume is fine. It hasn't been shown to be harmful. It's helpful to some people, not all people, in, for instance, controlling their the calories they're taking in. If they're working on maintaining a certain weight or losing weight, it's been helpful for some. And what I tell most people I work with is, if you were consuming enough artificial sweetener to have a problem, you're just consuming too much of a particular food. You know, there aren't artificial sweeteners in most fruits, vegetables, whole grains like whole wheat. You know, there aren't, if you're eating all of the foods that you should be off of my plate, you just wouldn't be consuming, I don't think, enough artificial sweetener to worry.
But if you're drinking 8 cans of Diet Pop a day.
Yes, and I offhand, I couldn't do the calculation. I don't think 8 is the best number.
No.
I'll drink a few on a big day, because I'm not a big water drinker, and I find that if I don't use other flavorings, I sometimes put fruit in my water, but I also use artificially sweetened drinks in order to keep my fluid intake up, because I'm just not very good at drinking water. And so that's just a tool for me, but I do watch. And indeed, you know, water is still in most places free and it's clean. So that's the other issue, is are you spending a lot of money on artificially sweetened drinks that you could use to purchase other healthy foods and drink some water?
Yeah. Steve, thanks, Pete. Appreciate it. Stephen Wapan, your turn.
Thank you, Larry and Beth, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For about the next 6 weeks, my wife is going to have to be on an all-liquid diet due to an esophageal tear, so they need to give it time to heal. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you would recommend as we're starting down that road.
So, wow. Unfortunately, I can't really give you recommendations. In our world of nutrition, the people who provide nutrition advice for medical conditions, that's a category we call medical nutrition therapy, are health professionals. So for nutrition specifically, it's registered dietitians. We have registered dietitians here at UW Health, and various clinics have them. Also healthcare providers, nurses, they're qualified to address medical issues. I'm not a registered dietitian, and my position is not such that my job enables me to provide medical advice. And so that would be something that she should consult with her physician to see, can they refer her to a registered dietitian?
You know, it would be hard, as I think about it, good grief, to get all of the vitamins, minerals, micronutrients, or what have you in a diet. It'd be pretty tough, wouldn't it?
So for various times where people are having trouble either using solid food or just consuming enough. So sometimes we get this when people are sick, when children are sick, or older adults who simply have lost some of their sense of taste and smell, who are losing weight and, you know, just can't seem to get enough calories in. There are products, they're medical products, medical foods like that come in a can. They're often used in hospitals when people are sick. And they have basically all the nutrients that you need in a liquid form. That isn't something most healthy people eat. It's, you know, it's a bit probably boring. And it isn't, you know, what we recommend for people who aren't sick or don't have a special need, but that's probably something that the registered dietitian could tell her.
That's probably what Steve's going to be told when they go in. It's good to know that there are at least liquid products out there that do meet all of your nutritional needs.
Yeah, they're meal replacement drinks that, you know, are often used in nursing homes, hospitals, places like that. But you can buy them in the store, and that may be an alternative for her if they recommend it.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that's good to know. Steve, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ella in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you next.
Hi. Actually, it's Stella. But I have a suggestion. You mentioned that you don't like to drink water. I would suggest trying reverse osmosis water. It tastes wonderful.
Okay, great.
And my question is the new nutritional labeling. Many, you know, prepackaged foods come in a bag with, say, of chips or cookies or whatever, crackers, that there's 11 ounces, 15 ounces, 8 ounces in the bag, and the serving and the nutritional information is given for one serving, and a serving size is like 1 ounce. And so many people sit down and eat the whole bag that it would be very helpful to have two columns, to have a column of one serving and a column of the whole bag for the nutritional analysis, and especially for the calories, because people don't divide out.
Yeah.
And plus, to try to measure out 1 ounce of chips is an interesting challenge. And
yeah.
there's also a situation we've run into with a packaged Indian dinner, that the package is clearly it's one serving, but the nutritional information on it calls it one half serving.
Yeah, that's and I think. Thank you for pointing that out, because when I talked about the changes in the new label, I neglected to mention this. And this is actually something that they are doing on more foods now. So what they do is they look at the serving size that is required for the label. And that's the serving size itself is changed for some foods because it's based on what people usually eat, not what on what I say they should or what somebody recommends. It's what they actually eat. So it's meant to be more realistic. That's the serving size. So an example FDA has used quite a bit in their materials is ice cream used to be a half a cup, but now the serving is two-thirds cup. It has gone up because people eat more ice cream at one sitting. The other thing they have changed is they are going to require some dual labeling. So a really common one that you might see, say, if you go in a convenience store, is there are many sizes of bottles of soda or pop, depending on where you live, soda pop. Mm-hmm. There are many sizes. And so they are looking at containers like that, also those little ice cream, cute little ice cream containers, and saying, is that an amount somebody would reasonably eat in one sitting, even if it's more than one serving? And if so, it has to be dual labeled. So on the side would be, for instance, a slightly larger bottle of soda. It would have the amount per serving, which is now 12 ounces. And if the bottle was 20 ounces, it would also have the amount of everything in it in that whole bottle. So at a quick glance, at least people's eyes would be drawn to the fact that there are two, and it might call out to them, I need to look at what I really am consuming if I take this whole thing in at once.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does. Thank you, Ella. Appreciate the call. Mitch in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mitch.
Hello. I looked across labels at different products, primarily cereals, and I look at the fiber content, and I find that one says X number of grams fiber. The next one says X number of grams of dietary fiber, which I don't know if that's any different. And the third one is that it'll say soluble and insoluble, and sometimes the totaling the two of them does not total the full amount of the grams of fiber that's listed on there.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So after a couple of other topics, fiber is one of my favorites because that's where I did my original research in as a graduate student. And I really believe in the importance of dietary fiber in our diets. I don't offhand know the difference between dietary fiber or total dietary fiber or fiber. I suspect they're all the same. But insoluble and soluble are different. Those are two broad classifications of fiber. Most of the foods that we eat have both. Not all, but most have both. Some have more than one and then the other. They're both important. The reason I'm not sure, but I think the reason they don't add up is they're to create that label is actually, and I know this only because I lived through doing the labels once before at a food company, redoing them, is there's a pretty complicated way that food companies have to adhere to that label. They have to measure, they have to round, they have to add, they have to measure, they have to use certain analytical techniques. And this is all to keep it standard so that the fiber on one label doesn't use one analytical method and the fiber on a different label is from a different analytical, and now you can't compare. So it's standard. And it's the best that's available. When they do this, they put out for comment what's the best way to analyze all these, and people comment. So one of the things that does happen, though, is there is rounding. And most of the errors that people point out to me on food labels, if I go back and look up the regulations and figure it out, they are rounding errors. So you take two things, you put them on there, then you round each of those and you put them together, and suddenly you're up or down a gram
a
or two.
Bit, yeah.
Yeah. And another place that's come out that people have not understood is they see an ingredient listing that looks like it has trans fat in it. And then trans fat is zero on the label. That's another rounding issue where there's a trace amount of trans fat, maybe not even enough that they can reliably analyze it. And so it becomes zero on the label because we don't put in, 0.0005 grams. We just make that zero. So that is also confusing. People say, how can it be 0 grams of trans fat when I see something in the label that looks like it might have it in? These are these intricacies of creating an accurate label.
Now, why do we need both, soluble and insoluble?
Well, the soluble is a more viscous fiber, so it tends to create bulk in our intestinal tract, trap water, help things move along well.
Yeah.
And the insoluble fiber does also create some bulk, not as much. It's not digested soluble fiber. We get a little bit of digestion by bacteria, produces the side effects we don't like, but also actually some beneficial side effects. The insoluble is not as well fermented. It's provides bulk in a different way, but the two together reduce the risk of different kinds of GI disease.
Mitch, I thank you very much for calling. I want to give Chris and Adams a chance to join in. Hi, Chris.
Happy spring.
Happy spring to you.
I have orchids blooming in my front room. I'm having a good day. I have leaky gut syndrome, which is just hell on wheels. But I wanted to give a little bit of advice to the man whose wife has an esophageal tear, because it's basically the same problem, just in a different part of the digestive system. I went and did a bunch of research online because I was really having problems with vomiting and being in a lot of pain and whatever. If they make a great big pot of from scratch chicken soup with a lot of cruciferous vegetables in it, chopped cabbage, broccoli, whatever you want to put in there, and then let it simmer so it thickens up. Don't put any extra gunk in it, but just let it cook down. And then strain it out, and the man can sit there and eat the big plate of food in front of his wife. But it's really nourishing, and it fills you up for at least a little while. And it's got a lot of good vitamins and minerals and stuff in it. And then the other thing is, if you call Community Pharmacy in Madison and ask them for some advice, she can get some herbal tea stuff that's healing. I don't want to give any medicinal advice over the phone, but there's a couple of other things. Instead of relying upon that canned stuff, because I don't know that that's necessarily really good for you, but there are things you can do. I mean, you can make lots of different kinds of soups and just strain the solids out of them and do that.
Chris, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Well, you know, when you're sick, what did Mom give you? Chicken soup.
That's true.
And there's a lot of nutrition.
Yeah, it could be. And if that's something that works for her, I don't know for the esophageal tear, but could be that someone could take a whole meal and just blender it up and have their nutrition liquid, but still get, you know, the benefits of the whole foods. But again, that would just be depend on what their doctor advises.
Evan in Pine River called to ask about the safety of the keto diet. How can you not have carbs and still be healthy?
Well, I don't think long-term you can. Certainly, the keto diet and other diets put emphasis on having what they would tell you are good carbs. The more extreme of those diets take out, you know, too many carbs, in my opinion. So when we're concerned about carbs, we're saying eat less of the more refined carbs. So eat less foods high in sugars, for instance, things like cookies and donuts and cakes and candies, and less white flour main ingredient products like white bread, white rice. Eat more whole grains. So those are still going to be carbohydrates, things like whole wheat flour, brown rice, wild rice, apples. Those are all good sources of carbohydrate. They'll have some simple carbohydrate, but they'll have more complex and more fiber. So that's really what we like to emphasize when we're talking to people about the kind of diets that take some carbohydrate out. Let's take out the carbohydrate that isn't adding as much nutrition, and let's put in the carbohydrate that's adding more nutrition.
John emailed that he's been buying a seasoning made in Mequon, Wisconsin. It's called Spike Veget, and it's great if you don't want salt. So it's one of these, so he uses it, Veget, on chicken and on turkey.
That's great. We do a lot of teaching in our educational classes about if you're taking sodium out of your diet, what are other ways to increase the flavor in your foods that don't rely on salt? And spices are a great way to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here we are about out of time. Beth, it's gone by. You know, where's the website to go for information on these labels?
The best couple of places, I think, is to Google FDA food label. They're the ones that create the label, so they have a lot of explanation and graphics. Also at USDA's site, look for the Food, Nutrition, and Information Center. They not only have information, they link you to other high-quality information.
Always a pleasure, Beth. Thank you so much for
being with
us. Beth Olson is an associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. I'm sure we'll have her back and we'll talk some more about nutrition and labeling. So tomorrow on Garden Talk, Neil DeBole comes back to talk about prairie gardening. Hope you can join us for that at 11 tomorrow and then 6 on Saturday morning. Or you can find Garden Talk online anytime. Stay with us.